It's time for Rose Chat on Blog Talk Radio. We're the only show on the airwaves dedicated to growing roses. We're glad you've joined us today. Our phone lines are open, and we'd love to hear from you during today's show. The number to call is 347-677-1870. Or send us a tweet using the Rose Chat hashtag on Twitter. Join us as we explore the world of roses.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of Rose Chat on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Chris Van Cleve. Now, we're in our second week of National Rose Month. That's right, June is a month set aside to celebrate everything that is the rose. And here at Rose Chat, we celebrate the rose really every week by bringing you the latest news, trends, and growing information. And we truly appreciate your support. Our sponsor, Annie Haven of Haven Brand Soil Conditioners, has a special offer for our listeners this month to help you celebrate National Rose Month. Now, if you place an order with Annie at manuretea.com, she'll include an extra bag of Moopoo tea when you place your order and mention Rose Chat. And if you call during the show today, she'll include an additional tea bag. That's two tea bags of Haven Brand all-natural soil conditioners just for listening to Rose Chat on Blog Talk Radio. Teresa Byington's joining me now from her garden in Indiana. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Chris. We're excited about the extra bags of Moopoo tea for sure. My husband was just out looking at his mini tomatoes this morning that he feeds with Moopoo tea, and he says they're over 3 feet tall. What happened to the mini part? So Moopoo tea is very successful in our garden.
3 foot tall tomatoes in Indiana already?
Well, we have very tall tomatoes, little tiny tomato fruit, but tall plants. Our plants are looking amazing, and thanks to Moopoo tea.
Wonderful.
Well, we're so glad that you joined us today on Blog Talk Radio, and we also appreciate Blog Talk Radio for their continued support in promoting our broadcast. You know, we hit the 250,000 listener mark last week, and we just want to say to all of you for your support. Chris and I are excited to talk to you about 250,000 listeners. And our first guest today is Mike and Angie Shoup. They're rosarians, gardeners, and rose solution experts, especially on growing roses in New England. They grow roses in Rhode Island and have a new book out entitled Roses for New England, and it's a comprehensive guide to growing sustainable roses in this beautiful section of the country. Welcome to Rose Chat, guys.
Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you for having us.
We're so excited to talk about gardening in New England. Gardeners growing in zones 3B to 7A really are presented with some unique challenges for sure. What do you look for in selecting roses for these colder climates?
We have to first decide where the garden is. The New England area goes from the Atlantic coast, where there are thousands and thousands and thousands of miles of coastline. And if you continue inland, it ends up in snowy peaks 4,000 feet above sea level. So the microclimates are enormous. So you determine where in that within those microclimates your gardener is, and you take it from there. You can go from 3B, which is in the northern tip of Maine, which is very cold. So we would suggest explore shrub roses, which thrive in that climate. And you can go all the way down to zone 7B, which is along the Atlantic coast in southern Rhode Island and Cape Cod and right along Long Island. And you can pretty much grow anything you want there.
Your book also emphasizes sustainability. So what do you consider the criteria for sustainability?
We define sustainability as a disease-resistant, winter-hardy rose that can thrive without chemical pesticides. And there are a huge amount of choices gardeners in our area have.
I saw the list of roses in your book, and it's just amazing to me how many fit that criteria. I think many of today's rose gardeners are very interested in rose varieties that are disease-resistant, but we still want beautiful roses. Even in my zone 5B garden, our winters can be harsh, or in the case of last winter, it wasn't very cold at all. So since so many conditions are prevalent in different regions. I'm so glad that you've taken this opportunity to speak to the New England issues that they have there. In your book, you lay out six basic steps for growing great roses that I think would be very helpful to our rose growers. So I'm going to go through each of the steps. And let's start out with step one, and that's on choosing plants. How important is it to start with a quality plant, do you think?
Well, in that section there, there's really two parts. We find that many gardeners go and they get seduced by pretty photographs and catalogs, or they'll see a rose in someone else's garden and they'll want that for themselves, even though it's not the right rose for them. They'll pick pretty hybrid teas that have to be drenched in pesticides, and if they're not willing to do that, then that rose will fail and they'll become frustrated. So the selection process addresses that part. And it also addresses the part about going to a garden center and actually picking the right plant within a variety to bring home. We talk about class grades 1, 1, 1.5, and 2. We talk about looking for certain characteristics that make one plant better than another. And then we also tell them to do a little homework, make a process out of it. Where are you going to plant it? What is the eventual growth habit going to be? Will you have enough sunlight? And if they go to the garden center armed with that kind of homework, then they'll make a good selection, and they're halfway home.
It's so true. Looks can really be deceiving. So what you're saying is a rose bargain might not be much of a bargain when the end result is disappointment. And then the other thing that happens is the rose reputation suffers because they think, oh, they're just fussy, or I can't have a rose, or what have you. So it is so good, I would think, to do a little homework and find out a little bit about the roses before you start your purchase. Well, step two deals with the soil. And so what do you consider to be good soil?
Well, good soil for us here in New England, and I think it's true everywhere around the United States, is good organic, nutrient-rich soil with a pH between 6 and 7. Soils vary widely from one coast to the other. The New England soils are very acidic, so we're constantly driving the pH up with lime. Whereas if you go out to California, I think it's just the opposite. So once you establish good soil with a balanced pH, then you selected a good plant, you're well on your way to being successful.
We also add a lot of organics, and our organic of choice, well, we have two actually, is horse manure, which is plentiful in our area, as well as seaweed.
What about adding mulch? Do you advocate adding a layer of mulch?
Well, we do. We advocate we'll use our horse manure and seaweed as a mulch as well as a soil conditioner, but getting seaweed isn't always a practical matter. So if you wanted to use pine bark mulch or pine needles or whatever readily available in your microclimate, your area, your garden center, this is fine. It keeps the weeds under control and preserves water.
It sure does, and that just happens to be one of my favorite parts of the whole planting process. I feel like once the mulch is down, everything looks neat and tidy, and the roses look like, okay, let's start the growing season. So I highly advocate putting down that beautiful layer of mulch that's going to keep the weeds down and retain all the moisture. Step three in your book is all about sunshine. And how much sun do roses in New England need?
We need about 6 hours of sunshine, continuous sunshine. And that can be hard to find in New England because we have a lot of trees. But we advocate that if you don't have the 6 hours, if you plant varieties with fewer petals, you can get by on about 4 hours of sun.
Mm-hmm. So fewer petals, less sun. That's a good rule of thumb to know about. I hadn't really put it that way before. Is there ever such a thing as too much sun for roses?
I think so. I know our friends out in Southern California will tell you that in the middle of the summer they get too much sun, where heat becomes an issue. It's not a major issue in New England, though. The last 2 weeks in July are historically the hottest 2 months of the year for us, And between the heat and the humidity, the roses may shut down, but it's only for a short period of time, and when we get a good drenching rain, they come right back. So heat's not a problem for us.
It's never been too much of a problem for us either, but I did notice last year during the drought the effects that heat could have. But like you say, one rain and the roses just jump right back, which just, again, tells us that roses are not the prima donnas that we have sometimes heard that they are. That one fresh rain just made all the difference. Take us into step four. We've heard that roses basically need an inch of water. So what is an inch of water? That's confusing to some people, I think. So what would you tell someone, how would they know that they had an inch of water?
Well, we don't really know if you have an inch of water either. That rule of thumb is a little misleading. We approach it from a different direction. We say that to keep the soil moist, whatever your soil is, if the soil looks dry, then water it. If it does, if it looks like it's a little wet, then water it. We're fortunate here in New England, at least in southern New England, our soils are sandy loam, and you could stand there all day long with the garden hose and it would just absorb that water readily. I know in other parts of New England where they have clay soils, it's a little different. The water will be held and they would have to water less. But then again, they would have to worry about soggy conditions, and that's not good either. So you really get into a microclimate issue on what an inch of water is. So it comes down to keeping the soil moist, and that's the best advice that we can give anybody.
Both Chris and I have close to 200 roses that we hand water. Do you have any tips how we could make the process of watering quicker or easier? What about soaker hoses? What do you think of those kind of processes?
Well, we do have irrigation. We have about 150 plants in the ground and about several hundred plants in containers. I happen to particularly like container rose gardening because it allows me to grow to get the very best out of any variety. But that's a story for another time. We use shrublers for our irrigation in our in-ground system, not because we don't like watering. It's just that we don't have the time to hand water that many plants two or three times a week in the warm weather. We don't like soaker hoses so much because if there's a blockage under the soil, you don't really know it, for one thing. And the other thing is the water at the front of the line in soaker hoses, the roses at the front of the line get all the water and the roses at the end of the line, not so much. So we like the shrubber system. It distributes water very evenly, in our case, about 5 gallons an hour.
Good to know. There's also products on the market called, I think one of them is called Soil Moist. Do you ever use anything like that in and around your roses?
I think you're referring to polymers. They look like sea salt in the container when you get them. Mm-hmm. And we use those from time to time in containers because when they absorb enormous amounts of water and it releases it very slowly. And that's a good thing to have in the summertime in a container, particularly in the hot weather. However, you got to be careful and make sure you hydrate those crystals before you plant them. If you hydrate them after you plant them, they can very well push a plant right out of the pot.
Oh, great. Good to know. Okay, now we're at step five, and it's all about fertilizer. So how often should we fertilize?
Well, our advice when we go out and do programs is once is not enough, and two is okay, and three is better. We do it four times here, but that's us. We do four light feedings, and we keep the nutrient level consistently high throughout the growing season. And we stop in mid-August. At that point, dormancy has begun, cooler nights, shorter days, and we allow the roses to gradually go dormant over several months. So our recommendation is to feed at least twice a season, depending on the plant, a half a cup of an organic product or half a cup of a chemical product like 10-10-10 is fine. But the key there, I think, is adding water and fertilizer together because plants can't absorb nutrients until they're in solutions. And most gardeners don't realize that. If you put a dry fertilizer down, it has to be watered and driving it down into the root zone so it can be absorbed.
I read that you also mentioned watering before you apply fertilizer. Why would that be?
Well, for the same thing. You want that moist soil. When you apply the fertilizer, there's a slight chance that roots could burn, a slight chance, because we don't use that much fertilizer. But we've seen instances where Folks have used a 10-10-10, and they've driven it into the soil without water. It singes the roots, and you see the crispiness in the foliage. So to avoid that, water, apply your fertilizer and water again. Just a good gardening practice.
Good tip indeed. Well, that brings us to our final step in your plan, and that's number six, and it's on managing pests and diseases. Could you explain to our listeners what an integrated pest management system is?
IPM is determining what your pest is and the best possible way to deal with the pest using the least offensive method to achieve that goal. That's the very simplified version of IPM. There was a time years ago when we first started doing programs when we got questions about insects and diseases. We would recommend this fungicide or that insecticide. And even in those days, we started losing our audience at that point. Everyone was keenly interested in rose gardening until they found out they had to buy chemicals, they had to buy sprayers, they had to buy goggles, gloves, protective suits, and get up in the middle of the night and spray because it was too hot to do it during the daytime. So they didn't want to do it, and over time, we didn't want to do it either. So we devised other ways of dealing with insects and diseases. And the short version of that story is you select varieties that have a demonstrated resistance to diseases in the first place. So you can almost take that whole issue of pesticides right off the table. And so that's our best way of dealing with insects and diseases is using plants that are resistant to begin with.
So true. And in thinking about pest management, how important do you think it is to add diversity in your garden?
We like companion planting. In fact, when we put in a sustainable rose garden at the in the front of our house, we decided that we were going to have a lot of different companion plants like lavender and daylilies and herbs. And they brought in a whole new, a whole different kind of
colony
of insects, beneficial insects. And I think they also kind of made it more difficult for the destructive insects to survive. So we've been very successful with our sustainable garden, and I think it's in mainly in part because of the plants we planted. Plus, we planted our roses much further apart, so we would have room for the companion plants.
There was a time not that long ago when I was a complete, total philistine about rose gardening. There would only be roses and nothing but roses in the garden. And my mother thought I was a jerk, and she was probably right. But when we started adding companion plants, I became a convert. I had an epiphany. I like lavender. I like daylilies. I will admit it. Like being at an AA meeting here, I'm converted. I crossed over. So now we're looking for other things to put even in our back garden, clematis and other non-rose plant material, which would enhance the garden.
You know, I totally agree. I love all plants. I particularly love roses, but I fell in love with the Gertrude Jekyll ideas of gardening, and so, you know, I agree welcoming all the other plants into your garden. They complement your roses, and the general health of your roses is just, you know, over the top, I think. Another thing that we're real excited about in our garden are the birds. We like to feed the birds and watch the birds and listen to the birds, and sometimes when I'm doing Blog Talk Radio, they almost drowned me out. I can hear them quite loudly this morning. How important do you think the birds are to the overall health of a garden?
I've never really thought of that. I mean, we do have bird feeders, and the birds come in. Sometimes they, like, dive bomb through the roses, and they do cause some damage to the canes. But I've noticed the birds the past couple of weeks just hopping around in the garden and in the potted roses, and I'm thinking that they're probably on insect patrol, so they're probably very helpful.
I don't know, maybe it's me, but I go out there, it seems like the same five robins show up. I don't know if it's the same five. I think it's them, but they follow me around. So if I turn over some soil and walk away, they're right over there, and they find a worm or a tick or a something in there to eat. So they're my buddies. I help them, and they help me, I guess.
Yeah, they're out there. They're out there getting those insects, I believe. And the robins are there. They're on patrol. They're stalking us to make sure we know what we're doing, I think. They're, and dive bombing into our windows on occasion. Let's see. In New England, there's definitely winter hardiness issues. So what are some cold hardy roses that you would recommend that our growers have in their gardens?
All the Rage and Superhero, the Easy Elegance series by Ping Lim. And those are hardy to zone 4. And they're very disease resistant. And they're not just disease resistant roses. They're beautiful roses. They have excellent form. You can cut them and bring them in the house. They grow in sprays. We have a class in our rose show for Au Naturel roses, and we always bring in our Easy Elegance roses for that class.
I have a new rose to me, and it's an Easy Elegance rose, and I just noticed this morning it has a beautiful bloom. So I think that's going to be one of my favorites this summer. Also, I saw listed was Earth Song. Could you tell us a little bit about that rose?
Well, Earth Song is a Griffith Buck rose, and it was hybridized in 1975. And we found that as we did the research for our book and we delved into the whole issue of sustainability, it was fascinating. And we found out that sustainability has been around for a long, long time. They didn't call it sustainability. They called it other things. But the need for winter hardy disease-resistant plants has been around. And Griffith Buck was certainly on target looking for what he called winter hardy roses. And Earth Song was one. We happen to like that. But there are many others, too. And he also found out that because he had no budget at Iowa State University for disease resistance, he could only test for winter hardiness. He came across that serendipitous occurrence that when he got one, he got the other that came along with it. So if you get a winter hardy rose, you will get a disease-resistant rose and vice versa, and we like that too.
And Earth Song is on 3 rose, so that's good all the way up to, you know, the coast of Maine.
Good to know. It is beautiful. Floribundas are a big hit with me. I just love that big pop of bloom. And I noticed on your list was Pretty Lady. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, Pretty Lady was developed by an English amateur hybridizer named Lynn Scrivens, and he came up with several really good cast iron varieties. Pretty Lady was probably the most attractive one, Baby Love being another one. But we like Pretty Lady. It looks like a hybrid tea. It blooms in sprays. It's got that, it's classified as a light pink, and it is light pink, but it's got apricot-y inner petals. It's not only disease resistant, it is drop-dead gorgeous. So that really fits our approach to sustainability, is that kind of rose. So that's on our list all the time.
I think that's going to be on my list. It looks very much like another rose that I have that I won't mention because it's given me some disease issues today, but Pretty Lady might just be a really good replacement for that Floribunda. Another rose on your list was Claire Matten, a climbing shrub. Could you tell us a little about that one?
Hey, that's Claire Matten, and it's was hybridized by Mion way back in 1960, and it's a climbing rose, and it's medium pink, and it's very disease-resistant. It's the first rose that blooms in our garden.
I'm looking out the window now, and it's 12 feet tall and 10 feet wide, and it's just peak right now. Even with the beatdown last night with the rain, it's gorgeous. So it has all the qualities of winter hardiness, it's reasonably disease-resistant, and it's a tough rose on top of that.
Well, you mentioned in our pre-show that you had 5 inches of rain yesterday, so if it's still beautiful this morning, that definitely moves it to the top of the list for sure. Beautiful and can sustain 5 inches of rain and still be beautiful, that's quite something. It's also listed as a fragrant rose, and you had mentioned that it was one of the most free-flowering roses, so I think that's a really good combination. Well, guys, you've given us so many beautiful choices to consider, And before we let you go, we want to hear a little bit about you. We love to hear stories about people and roses. So could you share with us how you guys got started growing roses?
Well, my gardening career started when I was 5 years old, and my mother and I planted radish seeds out in the backyard. It was back in the early 50s. At a time, I got some radish seeds, and she went out with a spoon, and we dug a little trough, and we threw the seeds in, and when they germinated, I was absolutely gobsmacked by how those little hard little seeds could turn into those green little plants, and that's what started it for me. And when you become introduced into gardening when you're a child, it stays with you for the rest of your life, and that was the case here. And then when Angie and I got married about, 50 or 60 years ago?
Oh, I think it was 50 years ago, yeah.
41 years ago. She joined me in that passion, and eventually we settled on roses around in the late 1980s, and we've been growing that hobby, and it's become a passion since then.
Well, that's a beautiful story, and I agree. You start children out growing things, and it's something that's going to be with them forever. Well, guys, thanks so much for being with us today. It's been our pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you.
Well, we've enjoyed talking to you and your audience.
Well, we hope you'll come back and chat with us again real soon. And have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Well, if you live in New England, and even if you don't, I would highly recommend you read Roses for New England. There's so much more in this book than we covered today, and I particularly like the section on rose fragrance and how they break it down. And the cover is so beautiful. It's the crowd-pleasing Julia Child Four Bunda Rose. So you can, to purchase the book, go to rosesolutions.net.
Wow, such great information for rose growers in New England or really anywhere in the country. When I read this book, it was like Teresa said, it's good for rose gardeners all over the U.S. and abroad. Now, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with rose hybridizer Christian Bedard from Weeks Roses. Stay with us. There's more Rose Chat Radio coming your way.
Hi, this is Jackie DeLia with Southern Post Journal, and today I want to talk to you about manure compost tea. This is Authentic Haven brand from California. One of the things that I really like about this is how easy it is to apply. It's a simple cotton bag filled with composted manure. You drop it in your bucket, typically a 1 to 5 gallon bucket of water. Drop in your tea bag. You'll notice some of the brown liquids coming out, and that's the manure starting to mix with the water. Once that's finished, 1 to 3 days, you'll have some fantastic manure tea ready for putting on your plants. So I've got my manure tea brewing for about 3 days, and I'm going to take a peek in there and see what it looks like. It's got a great color, it's got a great smell, and it's ready to be applied to my garden. So whether you choose to put it in your watering can and a sprayer, or just take a bucket and drench it into your vegetable garden, it's very easy to use. I use it in my garden, and I highly recommend it. So give it a try.
If you're growing Yabba Dabba Doo, Sugar Moon, or Ketchup and Mustard, then you have a little bit of the rose-creating genius of Christian Bedard in your very own garden. Christian's the chief hybridizer at Weeks Roses, and he joins us now from sunny Southern California. Good morning, Christian. Welcome to Rose Chat.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're so glad you joined us today. Now, I know our listeners would like to know a little bit more about how roses are created at Weeks. Can you give us a little bit of insight about your hybridization program there?
Well, that's something most people don't realize. The whole process takes about 10 years.
Wow.
So we start putting the crosses together on paper during the winter. I have nothing else to do winter time, so we have to keep our mind busy about crosses. Then when the plant is put together, the pollination happens between April to the end of June of that year, which is basically pollination. I mean, taking the male part from one flower and crossing it with a female part of another flower. So, which is the enters. So if everything goes well, you're going to have some hips, which are the little rounded fruit that you have when the flowers are spent. And those hips can seed. So normally about the end of August, those hips are starting to turn orange from the pollination that have been made in April, May, and June. And when they are fully orange, then we harvest them. Everything has to be harvested by family. And what I mean by family is we keep track of the mom and the dad of the seeds. So they are basically the parents of that seed that will turn into a seedling later. So we create bags with the mom and the dad, and we put the hips in the bag, like I said, the end of August all the way to about mid-September when the whole process is finished. Then, I'm going to explain it, but also you could go on the Week's website. There's a section, How We Create Roses, and there's a slideshow with pictures, so it's probably easier for people to see it. Because the next step I was going to say is we put the hips in the blender, and I know it might sound weird a little bit, but we have water in the blender, and we dull the blade a little bit just so they could extract the seed from the hips without really damaging the seed. So it comes a slurry, and we go through a different size of screen, and all the debris from the hips actually will go through the screen, and the seed will stay on top. And then we harvest, collect those seeds from the screen, put them in moist paper towel, put them in cold storage, which is creating an artificial stratification for about 8 weeks. Then, so we're already now, remember, we start the process in March, putting the crosses together on paper. So when everything is done, we're already, at this point, we're already mid-October about. Hmm. So the seeds will go in the cold storage for, like I said, about 8 weeks. And then we start planting right after Christmas. It's not too long that those little baby will come up. And we call them our rose baby because we're the father and, I guess, we're the creator, the daddy, or whatever you want to call us.
Right.
So then they come up real fast, sometimes within a couple of days. Sometimes some of them are already germinating in the refrigerator. So we just take them out, plant them. And to give you an idea how many we are producing is, on average, we will – have about 45,000 flower that we will pollinate.
Wow. 45,000?
Yeah, and this year we're already at 45,000. We're June the 8th, so we're going to be probably 52, 55 this year, which is a lot of flowers. If you think one by one, those flowers are emasculated, which means with a knife, we remove the anthers. We remove some of the petals to kind of expose the center, which is the female part. And then the next day we'll come with the paintbrush. The anther will dry, and with the paintbrush we'll collect the anthers, the pollen, and we will pollinate the style of a different flower we want to pollinate with. So one by one, those flowers, those 45,000, 50,000 flowers are pollinated, which will get us about 250,000 seeds.
Mm.
And
that's all done by hand?
That's all done by hand, except the blender process. Everything else is done by hand. The seeds are collected by hand. They're planted by hand. They are evaluated by hand, which is basically my hands that touch pretty much all those seedlings at some point. Sometimes I come home and honestly, my skin is not skin color, it's red because of the blood.
Right.
When they get big, I get a lot of scratches, and taking a shower in the morning, it's pretty painful.
Wow.
But I mean, again, you could put glove and everything, but I feel that it's a respect for the rose that I have to go gentle and touch them gentle, even though I want to kill them, the baby, because they're not selected, but I still do that gentle in some kind of a respect to them, you know. So, by late February, mid-March, those little seed that we planted right after Christmas time, they start to bloom already. So a lot of them, selection can be made without even seeing the bloom. That's something a lot of people won't realize is we are not only selecting for the bloom. It's actually one of the last steps. We are selecting for vigor, for habit, for foliage, for disease resistance. And then when everything is right, we're hoping we'll have a good bloom on it. If it's the other way around, if it's a nice flower, but everything else is wrong, it will be removed from the bed really quick in the selection.
Sure. So because if you don't have all that, you've got problems on the front end. So what good's a good bloom if it won't hold up on the shrub, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's why sometimes it is heartbreaking because you see a really nice flower. You know it's as far as flower goes, it is perfect. But, you know, let's say the plant is full of powdery mildew. So you have to make a call, and the call is pretty easy, is a no. So you take that seedling and you remove it from the seedling benches. But the peak time of selection in the greenhouse, it's mostly, like I say, about mid-March, April, and May, and still now going on in June, it's pretty active. So from the 250,000 seeds that are planted in the greenhouse, through the selection process, we will keep about 1,800 to 2,000 at the most. So that gives you a good idea how many I kill per year.
Yeah.
So I just retired my old pair of clippers that I've been using for almost 10 years. The blade is just dull. There's like almost a quarter of an inch of the blade, of the metal that's gone from being overused. And so on average, that pair, I probably have killed 100,000 seedlings per year, so we're talking a million seedlings so far.
Oh.
So it'll be part of the Rose Museum at Weeks. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but something like a little plate, a million rose kill or something like that, something along that line.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
But that's when the fun start is right after that, when you get those 1,800 to 2,000, they were one of a kind. And because, again, they came from a sexual process, which means every individual in that family are different. Because it's like mom and the dad will have two kids, so the two kids are different, unless they're identical twins, which is not very likely. But all the seedlings in the rose population in the family will all be different. Some of them will be all red in one family, but it's because it happened that way. The two parents are just very strong genetic on the red side, but some parents give you all the colors. There's one parent we've been using for over 13 years, as far as I'm concerned, because I've been with Weeks for 13 years, and that one I never can predict what he's going to give. He's giving all the color in the world, and which is great to use a parent, by the way, because you have all kind of seedling. When you have a family of 2,000 seedlings, they all red, like Oh My came from a family that was all red. I could tell you at the end I was tired of seeing red in that family because, you know, you want to see some color variation, but that cross of City of San Francisco cross with Crimson Bouquet, it was almost 100% red that came out of it, and we got Oh My from it. But you know, that's why it's nice to have some genetic variation in the seedling. But those go to the field after that, which is the real selection because they are garden rows. So I do care about how they perform in the greenhouse, but at the end they're gonna have to perform in the garden because that's where they're gonna be used in the garden landscape area. So those seedlings from one of a kind, like I say, because they're all individual, different, we're going to propagate 10 of each by budding going to the field. And then 2 years of selection in the field, they're going to go from 10 to 25 to 50 to 250. And then if everything goes well, again, you could count the year, you know, from 10 to 25 to 50. It's already 3 years, plus the 2 years they've been 1 year in the greenhouse as seedling, 1 year in pollination. Then Then we send them to the trial. We got some private trial ground in different climates around the United States, and that's when we could narrow it down again to, at the time they get to the trial, we're talking about 15 that are left from the 200,000, 50,000 that we started with.
Wow.
So very few makes it. Every little detail counts. And if the pedal is a little too pointy, out. If the pedal curl back, out. There's so many criteria that we could discard a seedling. And most people will say, wow, that seedling is beautiful. Yeah, it's not too bad, you know, but we're just not looking for the not too bad one. We're looking for the best one, you know.
Oh, definitely. And I guess that trial program is really where the rubber meets the road as far as how well they're going to do across the country, right?
Yeah. I mean, some seedling are really good in, let's say, California, but they don't do well anywhere else. So then it's when the decision comes, are we going to introduce it or not for more of the hot, dry climates? And some seedling do well pretty much everywhere, you know? And so that's also part of the selection. We want to see which one is have some black spot resistance, which one has some rust resistance, downy mildew, powdery mildew. There's a lot in the selection process that is not known. Like I say, very few will make it. And it's pretty much like, you know, those seedling, the one that will be selected, it's like winning the gold medal. Very few people will win a gold medal at the Olympics. So the five or six that will make it at the end, they have been outstanding the whole process time, which is 10 years. Because even at the end, a couple of years ago, we had a seedling, we had 8,000 of it. So we thought it was really good, and at the end, it was just not good enough, and we end up mulching it.
True.
I know for most gardener, thinking about 8,000 rows planted that are turning to mulch and turning to compost to go back in the field, it's kind of a different concept than all the plant they have in their backyard. But, you know, that's why we make sure that we bring only the best one to the market, and we want to make sure they will be easy to grow and produce a lot of flowers so people can enjoy them without too much work. So that's pretty much the goal of the breeding, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I guess, too, that speaks to – that's why rose trials are so important, like the one that just concluded at Biltmore and Rose Hills and, you know, the ones that are held abroad. We need to see how they're actually going to perform in gardens all across the country. You know, our guests before you this morning, Mike and Angie Shute, you know, grow roses in Rhode Island. And, you know, a rose that will perform well in Rhode Island may not perform well in you know, South Alabama where I'm at. So those are important steps along the way. I think it's important that consumers know that, you know, from 250,000 plants, you know, it all comes down to one sometimes.
Yeah, and there are regional performance, so that's why something that's good for people, they could go at the a local botanical garden or garden, whatever, and look around what kind of rose they have there, and they could see which one performed the best, you know, and that gives them an idea of what to grow in their garden, because it's not true that every roses will grow well everywhere. I mean, some of them do, but most of them don't.
Sure. Now, you mentioned Oh My a few minutes ago. Now, I have three shrubs of Oh My that I planted mm-hmm. last year in my garden, and I can tell you that this rose, you know, that I want to thank you for that 10 years of research and rose trials, because this is a superior rose. It does awesome in our garden. It's been in flower all since early spring.
And one thing interesting about, again, I mentioned about the family of Oh My, they were all red. I think there were very few pinks in it, but they were mostly red. But maybe out of, I don't remember the exact seed count, but it was over 1,000. So let's say 1,200, I think it's in that range. I think we've selected probably a good 15, 20 plants, seedling from that family. and planting them outside in the field, like I say, which is one of the selection to trial for garden performance, and they all burn except one. What I mean by burn is when the petal edge turns black-brown, you know?
Wow.
And that came from Crimson Bouquet, because that one will burn outside in the sun, except one, which became Oh My, because that one, the color stay. If you look at Oh My, the red will not fade blue, or it will not burn, which is one thing. Also, at the end, when everything is perfect, you get the good plant, the good branching, the good vigor, the good foliage, good flower form. You also want color stability, which means a yellow that fades yellow, at least with some yellow. It doesn't go all the way white. And some of the older red are going blue or pink. But if you look at Oh My, there's barely any difference between the fresh and the faded color, and it doesn't burn. So that's kind of how we make the selection. At the end, is like, yeah, it is, like you say, it is an improved seedling of what is already on the market. So
yeah, that's so true. I wanted to talk a little bit about fragrance in roses. You know, everyone, I know we had a garden party here a couple of weeks ago in our garden, and the first thing people did when they started to walk through the garden was they began to smell all the roses. And so I wanted to hear from, and I know our listeners want to hear from hybridizers and what your thoughts are about fragrance. And are you looking for fragrance, and are you trying to achieve fragrance in your crosses?
I think for, I'm going to say the last 4 or 5 years, focus has been so intense on disease resistance, you know, with all the shrub being very popular for landscape. And I have to admit that we were still looking for fragrance, but our focus was not directly on that. Not saying that's not important, but we crossbred a lot of shrub line with hybrid teas and to try to get the disease resistance of the shrub into the hybrid tea. But fragrance is not one that comes with disease resistance. A lot, actually, the gene for fragrance is probably very close to the gene on powdery mildew susceptibility, because a lot of the fragrant rose will be more susceptible. So that's when being focused on disease resistance, probably we had some good fragrant rose in the greenhouse, but we didn't select them because they were not up there on disease resistance. Wow. Now, that being said, it seems like there's a gradual switch back to hybrid teas and Floribunda and Grandy. At least that's what I've shown last year in our sales. The shrub sales have went down a little bit, and the hybrid tea sales are up. So the last 2 years, yes, we put back more hybrid teas and more more fragrant hybrid tea and more fragrant Floribunda in the breeding line. Like I say, we never fully stopped trying to get the fragrance, but we just put it as a secondary focus a little bit. But now it is very important. You're right about people putting their nose in the flower before they almost even look at them, you know. So it is definitely part of a very important selection criteria.
Yeah. No, I know your introduction of Sugar Moon was a welcome surprise to have a quite hybrid tea that is disease resistant and fragrant. It has a wonderful fragrance.
It, to me, in the catalog, what we call catalog fragrance, you know, there's always a little something. When I mean catalog fragrance, you never say no fragrance at all. You know, you're gonna say a slight fragrance, which in fact is probably no fragrance. But there's definitely some variety that are really powerful fragrance, and Sugar Moon is one of them. I mean, it's hard to stand after you smell it. You just almost fall on your knee because it's so powerful, you know?
Yeah.
There's very few roses that can be claimed as being as fragrant as Sugar Moon, you know? A lot of them, like I say, they have something in the catalog. They'll say good fragrance or medium fragrance, but that one is powerful, you know. It won the best fragrance at Rose Hill last year, and it is a very strong fragrance.
Yeah, it's an awesome rose. We have one shrub of it in our garden, and it is beautiful. Some of the names of roses that come from wheats are always very interesting, and people ask me all the time, how in the world do they come up with the names of those roses? And, you know, when you look at a bloom of the Floribunda ketchup and mustard, you sort of think of that. So can you tell us a little bit about how you come up with the names for roses?
You know, and ketchup and mustard is a funny one because a lot of people are reacting on the name on that one. It is a fun name, and that's why you want to come up with something that people will remember, you know. If you call it sweet red and yellow, well, people will forget about the name, you know. If you call it ketchup and mustard, then it'll stick in people's head, and they will remember that one. So that's why when you're looking for a name, you need to find something catchy that also fits the variety well. You don't want a name to describe a pink and you actually have a yellow rose. After working 10 years on developing the variety and getting ready to put it in commerce, finding the right name is almost the most important part right after trialing, because a bad name will kill a good rose, and a good name will sell a bad rose. So the naming process, there's so many different stories I could tell. But I'll just mention the story on ketchup and mustard. As a breeder, when you look at, like I say, so many seedlings in the field, you don't remember them all, you know. So sometimes we just use some color description like that to remember them. And that one, since its first bloom, even in the greenhouse, and I should have started saying that when we have 250,000 plant and little seedling in the greenhouse, you're going to remember very few of them. I mean, honestly, very few of them you're going to remember. But, I mean, Tom K. Root was with me in the greenhouse when we saw ketchup and mustard for the first time. And we remember exactly where it was in the greenhouse with all the other 100 or 200,000 seedlings around it. So it already made an impact on us. And so it was basically ketchup and mustard was a nickname that every time we're walking the field, oh, this is the ketchup and mustard, blah, 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 and then we describe the plant again. Because technically the number is S128-1 on ketchup and mustard. So that means it came from the family of 128, and -1 was the first seedling selected in that family. But, you know, instead of referring at it all the time at S28-1, and it also helps the salesman to remember it. So we say we nickname it ketchup and mustard. So came the time to come up with an official name for the catalog, and we look at many options. We have a folder with names that we've been accumulating for the last 15, 20 years. So many names that people proposed, suggested, and they're all listed. And we go through those lists, and we look in the dictionary. We look at, you know, anything that could inspire a name. We look at some music, some songs, title, or stuff like that. And we had other options on ketchup and mustard, but just nothing that was as obvious describing the variety as ketchup and mustard. So Tom and I, we just, like, sat down in the office at one point and say, well, let's just keep it ketchup and mustard, you know, so be it. And some people like the name and some people just don't totally hate the name, you know. it is a difficult process to find the right name. But in the case, I mean, I still feel good about the name personally. I've got some people saying it was not a good name for the rose, and some people say it was an excellent name for the rose. So can never please everybody, but as far as describing the rose, it is red and yellow, so it's ketchup and mustard. And as far as people will remember it, yes, they will. So we achieved the goal of making an unknown seedling under S128-1 known as ketchup and mustard, and people will remember that name. So that's pretty much the process of naming a rose. If I could mention just maybe another story on sometime, like Julia Child, we have, before the rose get introduced, we send sample plants to all the nurseries and garden centers that are week's customers, so they could preview the variety 1 year ahead of time. Julia Child was an All-American Rose Selection winner, so it could not have been named yet a year prior. So what happened is, actually, Julia Child was a customer at one of Week's Garden Center, and she showed up at the nursery, and she said, wow, what is that? And so we got contacted after that, and she would like to the rose name after her, and we just thought that was a great idea. So pretty much every rose has a story about how they get their name, you know. It's always quite interesting how we, you know, from a little seedling in the greenhouse, how they came from a number to the name, and each of them has a different story. So, but it is a complex process to get the right name to the right the right roses.
Yeah, that is so true. You know, and I think roses with names like ketchup and mustard and, you know, the beautiful shrub rose that came out this year, Yabba Dabba Doo, you know, those appeal to children. And I could speak to that a little bit from personal experience. We had our shrubs of ketchup and mustard planted in our front yard. And one of our neighbor's daughters comes by the house, and they walk in our neighborhood, and she tells her mama, we've got to go by that house and see ketchup and mustard.
And that's right.
Yeah, so, you know, I think those types of interesting names and the look of the rose, you know, is very appealing to young people. And, you know, anything we can do to draw a child away from all of the distractions of this digital age we live in and get them out into the garden, admiring roses, I think we've done something there. So it's a wonderful thing.
Well, there's a big gap in generation between the baby boomer and the next two generation coming as far as gardening. That's probably why one of the reasons the rose businesses are down, because the other generation are, like you said, there have not been, I mean, in general, not really been involved in gardening much. And if we could find a way with, like, funny names like that to get them involved in planting a rose bush or two and be successful with them, then maybe they'll get into more gardening and projects, and which is good for our business. And it's good for them, too. They get outside instead of watching TV and playing on computer. They could do some play outside a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. Now, our time is running short this morning, but I did want to talk to you just a moment about a very special rose that's being officially introduced next year, and that's the Coretta Scott King rose. And can you tell us a little bit about this rose?
Yes, actually, it's also one that I hybridized that one, and it was I think it was a great honor for Mrs. King. When we work with the Coretta Scott King Foundation, they say that was this year was the 50th anniversary. I had a dream speech, and we just thought it would be nice to have a rose to commemorate Coretta Scott King life, and a portion of the sales goes back to the Coretta Scott King Foundation. The rose itself, to me, is one that is almost all the time have those perfect bud shape. I have not seen that often on a rose that almost every stem comes with that, you know, classic high center bud with a good plant, vigorous, mostly upright, strong vigor, beautiful foliage. A lot of the cream roses will have a pink blush. This one is more like a coral orange blush, which makes it, to me, very novel. Not so much strong fragrance, a little bit, I will say, but the good vigor, the bud shape, everything is pretty good on that rose.
Well, it certainly is a beautiful rose. You know, we planted a bed of those roses here at the Birmingham Botanical Garden in honor of Mrs. King and the 50 years forward project that's going on here to commemorate 50 years of the Civil Rights Movement here in Birmingham. And I was up there a couple of weeks ago, and they were in beautiful flush of bloom. And I'll tell you, it's wonderful that we can name roses that appeal to children and name roses that commemorate events and wonderful people in our lives. Christian, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out of your day just to spend some time with us here at Rose Chat. We appreciate what you do, and we hope that you'll come back and be with us again sometime.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. That was nice chatting with you.
It was great chatting with you. You have a great afternoon. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks.
Hey, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with our weekly roundup of Rose shows being presented around the country. So stay with us.
Hi, I'm Phil Paul with the American Rose Society. My family has been growing roses for some 50 years. My wife and I have grown roses across the United States for the last 25. There's nothing more breathtaking than a beautiful display of roses in full bloom.
No matter if you're an experienced rosarian or are just beginning your first rose garden, the American Rose Society is here to help. It's a tremendous resource for making your rose garden the envy of your neighborhood. There's even a rose photography contest for members to showcase the best of the best. Each member will be published in the American Rose Magazine.
We invite you to become a part of one of America's oldest horticultural societies and the home of our national floral emblem.
For more information on becoming a member of the American Rose Society and on the Rose Photography Contest, visit ars.org.
Hey, it's time to mark your calendars. Here are a few of the Rose shows that are happening next week. On June 15th, there are several opportunities to see beautiful roses. The Iowa Rose Society in Ames, Iowa, the Cross Point Metropolitan Rose Society in Sterling Heights, Michigan, the Minnesota Rose Society in Twin Cities, Minnesota, the Syracuse Rose Society in Syracuse, New York, the Cincinnati Rose Society in Cincinnati, Ohio, and the Cleveland Rose Society in Cleveland, Ohio, the Rhode Island Rose Society in Wickford, Rhode Island, the Fort Vancouver Rose Society in Vancouver, Washington. And my personal favorite this week is the Indianapolis Rose Society in Indianapolis, Indiana. Then on June 16th, we have two shows listed, the New England Rose Society in Boylston, Massachusetts, and the Madison Rose Society in Madison, Wisconsin. You can check out the full listing of Rose shows around the U.S. at roseshow.com.
Wow. Teresa, it's been a great morning here on Rose Chat on Blog Talk Radio. Mike and Angie shared some great insights with us about growing roses in New England, and what a great day to have Christian Bedard on to talk about all these wonderful roses that come out of the rose fields at Weeks Roses.
Oh, it was wonderful. I learned a lot, made some notes, and added a few more roses to my wish list, actually.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, National Rose Month is still going on. I want to encourage our listeners to share pictures of your roses with us this month. You can post them to our Facebook page at facebook.com/RoseChatRadio, or you can tweet them using the Rose Chat hashtag. Whatever you do, share roses with the people around you and with those within your circle of influence. They'll be glad that you did. I want to thank our listeners for joining us today on Rose Chat for Blog Talk Radio. We'd love to hear your comments and feedback on today's show. You can send us an email at grow@rosechat.info. You can find us on Twitter just by following the Rose Chat hashtag. Like us on Facebook, and be sure to check out our website, rosechatradio.com. You know, we believe that becoming a member of the American Rose Society is a decision that you won't regret, and we invite you to check out the American Rose Society's website at ars.org.
Hey, it's been great to be with you today. And until next time, happy gardening from your friends at Rose Chat.
Great job, everybody.